Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Welcome back to Calf Chats. I am Major Rhianne Wentz, and I am joined by the illustrious Major Corey Squires, United States Marine Corps. We're going to just dive right into United States versus Flanner. I think probably we'll have some pithy banter later.
Illustrious banter, I'm sure.
What are we dealing with in United States versus Flanner, Major Squires?
All right. So Flanner is a 3-2 opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. The majority opinion written by Judge Johnson with a dissenting opinion from Chief Judge Olson and Judge Sparks. The facts in this case don't really matter that much. So let's just say that the accused in this case was under investigation by NCIS. And the procedural timeline is kind of more interesting. So it's maybe not even a procedural timeline, the investigative timeline, for lack of a better word. In May of 2021, the accused is rolled up by NCIS and interviewed. And during the course of that interview, well, there really is no interview because he invokes his right to counsel out of the gate, writing on the rights waiver form, "I would like to have a lawyer present during this questioning." So he invokes his right to counsel and NCIS terminates the interview. The same month, he makes his first trip to the Marine Corps Defense Services Organization. Opinion is, there's not a lot of detail in the record as to what happened during that first meeting with defense counsel, and that's pretty normal because the attorney-client privilege would protect almost virtually everything from that, from disclosure. But it was disclosed at some point in the trial record that he did meet with defense counsel in May, and then he went back in June and met with them again. By the time September gets around, the accused is on legal hold. He has passed the end of his active service contractual obligation, and his family has moved away. So he was anticipating getting out of the Marine Corps, and he's stuck on legal hold. So he asks his staff non-commissioned officer if he is going to get military counsel for an interview with NCIS. And his staff NCIC goes and contacts the SJA, and the SJA advises he will get counsel appointed to him only if charges are preferred. But it's kind of like the SJA is telling the staff NCO, for the staff NCO's awareness, and asks him not to relay this to the accused. But that doesn't happen. The staff NCO advises the accused that he will receive counsel only if charges are preferred. So for those non-Marine Corps listeners out there, the Legal Services Administration Manual is the Marine Corps regulation that lists the detailing timeline for defense counsel. 10 days of pretrial confinement, 5 days of being served notice of preferred charges, 5 days of notice of an Article 32, things like that. But there's also a policy memorandum from the Chief Defense Counsel of the Marine Corps that oversees the Marine Corps Defense Services Organization, and that allows for the detailing of counsel in a variety of pre-preferral situations, including the one the accused was in, investigated by law enforcement, and the detailing authority reasonably believes that the investigation could result in court-martial or adverse administrative action. So we're in a situation where he did not rate under the LSAM the detailing of a Marine Corps defense counsel. However, the detailing authority in the Defense Services Organization had discretion to give him counsel. That's not to say that he wasn't like allowed to speak with the defense counsel. The DSO holds typically like walk-in hours for Marines that are not pending court-martial maybe, but are in need of legal counsel. But again, the record is sparse as to what counsel was actually made available to him. In any event, the accused schedules an interview with NCIS in September, and the interviewing agent documents that he was, you know, incorrectly advised about the lawyer by his command. And so at the second interview that the accused schedules, NCIS confirms his desire to speak with NCIS despite the previous rights invocation that the accused understood military defense counsel would be detailed only if charges were preferred, and that the accused understood he could have civilian counsel present at his own expense. And then they go back through the rights advisement, the standard rights advisement waiver that includes, you know, right to remain silent, right to counsel, right to terminate the interview at any time. Accused, you know, waives those rights and they proceed with the interview. At trial, the defense moves to suppress this second interview, and the military judge makes some findings of fact, and basically those findings are that the various actors in the case gave the accused an inaccurate belief that he could not be appointed a lawyer until charges were preferred. Based on that misunderstanding, the accused went forward with the interview, and that the ultimate rights waiver was based on a misunderstanding. The military judge at the trial level concluded that although the interview was voluntary, the waiver of the right to have counsel present during the interview was not knowing or intelligent, and granted the motion to suppress. And the Navy and Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed this ruling in a 3-0 decision, concluding that the judge's findings of fact were not clearly erroneous and she did not abuse her discretion. Puts us kind of at the procedural posture for the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces opinion that found to the opposite.
Yeah, and so just a reminder for our listeners, so this was an Article 62 appeal, which is an interlocutory appeal. And this was a Navy TJAG certified issue. And the certified issue was, did the military judge abuse her discretion when she suppressed appellee's non-custodial, pre-preferral, self-scheduled interview with law enforcement in which appellee waived the rights to counsel and to remain silent? And again, I when I start reading these cases, I like to look to the issue. I like to look at how the facts are sort of laid out, and I try to guess about how this case is going to turn out. And with an issue like non-custodial pre-preferral self-scheduled interview, you have kind of an idea of maybe how this is going to turn out. As a reminder, as Major Squires just talked about, the standard of review in this case is abuse of discretion, but viewed in the light most favorable to the party that prevailed at trial because this is an Article 62 appeal. Remember, an abuse of discretion is basically the wrong facts or if the court's decision is influenced by an erroneous view of the law. And that ends up being what the court kind of hangs its hat on here. Now,
why might there be an erroneous view of the law in this case? It seems so clear cut.
Oh, my goodness. Major Squires, it's almost as if you've seen my script because Major Squires and I do use a script. And I was asked by Major Barrett and Major Morgan to clarify the record that they, in fact, do not use a script. I don't know why they felt the need for that to be clarified, but I'm doing so here. But that's a great point that you bring up, Major Squires, about why there might be an erroneous view of the law. Because before I want to talk about how the court analyzed this issue in Flanner, I want to talk about a case called United States versus Mott. And the relevant question in United States versus Mott was whether the appellant knowingly and intelligently waived his Fifth Amendment and Article 31 Bravo UCMJ rights to counsel. Mott argued that his severe mental disease prevented him from doing so. In discussing this issue, CAF wrote in a footnote, "Consistent with our precedents, we note that in the military justice system, the accused's right to counsel and the requirement of knowing involuntary waiver are not limited to custodial interrogation." The emphasis on custodial is not mine, but in the original footnote, it's underlined. So that's the footnote. That's the information that the trial judge has going into deciding Flanner. And now that we have that background, let's dive into Flanner. Bottom line, CAF held that Flanner did not have a right to counsel at this interview per the Fifth Amendment, as implemented by Military Rule of Evidence 305, nor Article 31 Bravo, UCMJ, nor Marine Corps policy, for many of the reasons that Major Squires already talked about, but we'll get to that in just a second. The Fifth Amendment provides that we cannot be compelled to incriminate ourselves. And we've talked a little bit about Miranda on this podcast before, but just as a reminder, Miranda warnings are the preventative measure created by the courts to protect an individual's Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. Basically, the custodial interrogation is so potentially coercive that an individual should have a right to have a lawyer there to help them not incriminate themselves. So the right protecting us from self-incrimination has two parts, according to the Supreme Court, the right to silence and the right to counsel. Now, the Fifth Amendment right to counsel only applies to custodial interrogation. So basically, if you think about it like a math problem, you have to have custody plus interrogation equals you have to read Miranda. And the factors that CAF uses to determine whether someone is in custody are explained in United States versus Mitchell, and they include whether the person appeared for questioning voluntarily, the location and atmosphere of the place in which the questioning occurred, the length of the questioning, the number of law enforcement officers present at the scene, and the degree of physical restraint placed upon the suspect. Now, there is a ton of jurisprudence, a ton of case law at the federal level, at the Supreme Court level, sort of deciding what constitutes custody and what doesn't. But we're going to stick with these factors because they play really heavily, obviously, into Cass' decision here.
Okay, well, hang on, wait. So I'm just making sure I'm tracking. Easy understanding Miranda requires custody, but footnote 10 in Mott said that service member rights are broader, and the Fifth Amendment right to counsel or some right to counsel applies even in a non-custodial interrogation.
Yes. And the quick answer to your conundrum, perhaps, the quick answer to your conundrum is that Kaff decides in Flanner that Mott is just flat out wrong.
What about Article 31 Bravo?
Well, that's a great question, Major Squires. I would love to talk to you about 31 Bravo. Thank you for bringing it up. So in talking about 31 Bravo, yes, 31 Bravo rights are more broad, right, than Miranda. And again, service members are entitled to both of those things. But 31 Bravo does not provide a right to appointed counsel. So if you look at the text of 31 Bravo, there is no right to counsel there. And remember, too, that in the context of some questioning by law enforcement, 31 Bravo could be triggered while Miranda is not. 31 Bravo has a lower threshold because those warnings must be given to anyone, quote, suspected of an offense, whereas Miranda is only required in a custodial interrogation. So 31 Bravo is completely silent on the right to counsel. And as a result of this silence in Flanner, Kaff held that 31 Bravo did not guarantee Flanner the right to counsel in this non-custodial interview. And this is where that footnote in Mott comes in that you are, I think, rightfully hung up on, Major Squires. And as a reminder, that footnote said that the accused right to counsel is not limited to custodial interrogation. In Flanner, Kaff flat out says that this is an incorrect statement of the law and also that it was dicta. And so it doesn't control its decision, and it didn't have to control the decision of the trial judge, which therefore sort of means that her decision was influenced by an erroneous view of the law. 31 Bravo doesn't require counsel here, but I want to talk a little bit about why Kaff didn't find it to be a custodial interview, and it was for some of the factors that we talked about. And I want to remind listeners that, as Major Squires said, this was in the NCIS office. So this was in the police station. This is in that inherently, concerningly coercive environment. But what Kaff says is that it's not custodial because he, Flanner, initiated the interview. He voluntarily appeared at the scheduled time. And although he was at a law enforcement office, although he was at the NCIS office, that did not per se mean that Flanner was in custody. He acknowledged that he could stop the interview at any time, and he, and this is a quote, Apelli laughed and joked with the agents over the course of about 2.5 hours. And for all of those reasons, Kaff held, the atmosphere of the interview would have made it transparent to a reasonable person in Apelli's position that he was not subject to formal arrest or restraint on freedom of movement of the degree associated with formal arrest. So Kaff ultimately concludes that Flanner was not in custody, and so the Miranda right to counsel wasn't triggered. Now, listeners, and maybe even Major Squires, you might ask, what about that first interview, right? That first interview where he says, he invokes his rights, and he says, I would like counsel. And even if neither Major Squires nor our listeners are going to ask it, I'm going to talk about it because Kaff addressed it. And essentially, Kaff found that even if the first interview had been custodial, NCIS agents scrupulously honored the law, and that's the language from Kaff, by terminating the interview after he invoked. 4 months later, Apelli was the one that contacted NCIS and scheduled the second interview. Given that Kaff determined that the second interview was non-custodial and that Flanner's right to counsel had not been triggered, there was no problem. Now, Major Squires, I'm going to turn the tables on you. Do you want to talk a little bit about why it was so important that after Flanner invoked his right to counsel at the first interview, that law enforcement officers terminate that interview?
Well, yes. So there's a Edwards and its progeny are very, very clear that the right to counsel invocation is to be scrupulously honored. Without going into what constitutes an unequivocal invocation of the right or any of that discussion here, but a clear invocation of the right to counsel terminates the interview. Now, there's a harder question of, if that first interview was non-custodial, What would have happened if he'd invoked the right to counsel and it had not been scrupulously honored? Because he was invoking a right that technically doesn't exist. I don't know how to talk about this because that is an issue that I've never seen.
Well, if it's non-custodial, based upon the decision here in Flanner today, if it's non-custodial, I don't know that law enforcement has to do anything. If it's the right to silence, that's a different question, I think. But if it's the right to counsel, because there's no right to counsel in 31 Bravo, according to Flanner, then I think, I don't know that Edwards applies. What do you think?
Well, yeah, right. Edwards doesn't apply when you're not in custody. Miranda doesn't apply when you're not in custody. And
right.
Edwards, you know, is part of the Miranda line of cases. It's not uncommon for custodial interviews to be terminated because an invocation of the right to counsel, and I'm talking kind of in civilian law enforcement jurisdictions, and then law enforcement to reapproach in a non-custodial setting where they don't need to read Miranda rights. That's a tactic that I'm sure our civilian practitioners see pretty routinely in criminal cases. So there's a lot to think about in terms of like what law enforcement tactics this decision enables within the military. I think if we're talking takeaways for the field for this case.
Before we get there.
Are we not talking takeaways?
I do want to talk takeaways. I just want to talk about the Marine Corps policy that you mentioned and the way CAF talked about it. And then we'll talk about takeaways.
Okay.
Deal. Okay. Major Squires mentioned Marine Corps policy and sort of the discretionary nature of it. And CAF determined that because the Marine Corps policy did not require the detailing of counsel, only that and Major Squires mentioned that the only times defense counsel shall be detailed is pretrial confinement, referral, Article 32, admin set boards, or as otherwise required by law or regulation. CAF held that none of these situations were present for Flanner. Any language in this policy or others outside of this provision were discretionary rather than mandatory. And so as a result, that doesn't provide Flanner with the right to counsel either. So as a result of all of this analysis of Miranda, 31 Bravo, CAF determined that the military judge did abuse her discretion because it was influenced by an erroneous view of the law. She erred in assuming without deciding that the appellee had the right to counsel during his second interview. Second, she erred in concluding that it was a mistaken belief that Flanner could not be appointed military defense counsel until preferral. Simply put, it was not mistaken. He did not have a right to counsel at this non-custodial pre-preferral interview. That was an accurate belief. As CAF succinctly put it, under Marine Corps policy, he could have been appointed counsel for the second interview subject to the discretion of the detailing authority. However, he had twice sought legal services from the DSO and twice he left without securing appointed counsel. Okay, so now that we understand how we got to the conclusion, what are some takeaways that you've been thinking about, Major Squires?
Okay, my takeaway from this case is that, one, everyone should understand the black letter law. Article 31 Bravo does not include a right to counsel. Article 31 Bravo includes the right to understand the nature of the offense and the right to not make a statement or to remain silent. And really, like this, as much as the judge is said to have abused her discretion, Mott footnote 10 is just unequivocally wrong. In the old analysis of the military rules of evidence, if you go back to the 2016 MCM in Appendix 22, and it's not reprinted verbatim in the new MCMs, which is a constant source of frustration for me because there really was some good analysis. It is very clear in the discussion to 305 that the there are differences between the statutory and constitutional privileges. So Article 31 does not provide any right to counsel at an interrogation. Consequently, interrogations which involve only the Article 31 privilege against self-incrimination do not include a right to counsel. For instance, requests for voice or handwriting samples or requests for bodily fluids or any non-custodial interrogation. It was always this way. However, every service and every case that I've ever seen that uses the formal Article 31 Bravo rights forms, it includes both Miranda and the Article 31 Bravo rights. So I have never seen a command investigation or any investigation with a non-custodial interview where they've deviated from that form. And as a result, even though the constitutional and statutory rights are different, in practice, they were always advised of both in custodial interviews, in non-custodial interviews, in non-interrogations. I would really be cautious about changing that practice because if law enforcement or counsel advising an investigator starts trying to get cute with the rights advisement and saying, you know, tell him he's not under arrest so he doesn't think he's in custody, and then don't talk about his right to counsel, or if he invokes his right to counsel, continue to interrogate him. I think we're going to go down a road that we just don't need to go down. There has been no impairment in the functioning of law enforcement activity in the United States Armed Forces by using the Article 31 Bravo standard rights forms that also includes the Miranda rights. So my takeaway would be to change nothing. Understand that there is a difference, and that a non-custodial interrogation technically does not require reading of the right to counsel, but I'm hesitant to advise any practitioner to start playing games with that.
Yeah. I think from a counsel perspective, and you and I had talked about this before we did the podcast, about that likely what happened. I mean, well, so in practice, it's hard to detail a defense counsel to go with every client to an interview because we just don't have the capacity. And I am perhaps speaking too generally, but I think across services, defense counsel just don't have the capacity to go to law enforcement interviews with their clients. And so it would be really hard for us to say, well, you should go, like, there should be a policy change, there should be a preference for going to law enforcement interviews.
Usually, it is more advisable for the accused to not interview with law enforcement at all than it is to interview with law enforcement, even with an attorney present. That's in my experience in most cases. So even assuming that, you know, we gave a bunch of extra resources to the Defense Services Organization, I don't know that lots of defense counsel would be, you know, walking, you know, side by side with their client into an NCIS office for an interview.
Yeah, because even if you have a lawyer, an attorney by your side, the chances that you say something that is not exactly what you meant, or gives the law enforcement officer a foothold or something, right, that is just probably not going to be helpful to you. So I think you are right that in my experience, broadly speaking, without having any kind of facts before us, I think generally my inclination is to advise against talking to law enforcement.
I mean, I personally, even if I were represented by the esteemed Major Wentz, I could find a way to say something stupid.
Okay. But speaking more specifically about advice to counsel. So, you know, for me, the takeaway might be that when defense counsel do a suspect rights advisement, or they talk to a client before they're detailed, right, there's usually like a limited scope of representation where they say, okay, I'm gonna talk to you about this purpose, and you know, kind of once you walk out the door, I'm probably not going to be your lawyer anymore. You may get a lawyer if charges are preferred or you go in pretrial confinement, right? All of those limitations. But I think as part of that rights advisal, I think I would mention that this is going to take a long time. Law enforcement investigations take a long time. And if you reinitiate, if you schedule an interview, if you go down there, then there's not going to be a whole lot that a defense counsel is going to be able to do to get that statement thrown out. So just as like to help them understand that if they schedule an interview with law enforcement, then and they waive their rights, that, you know, it's probably going to be fine. Like, there's probably not going to be a whole lot we can do with it. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
So one of the things, you know, we talk about these cases in our office and talk about from our different perspectives and experiences. And one of the things that Major Barrett brought up that I think is a really valuable takeaway point for practitioners, CAF is reading statutes very, very literally. They're not reading anything into them. It's very black and white. And CAF is saying, okay, this is very specifically, very clearly what the statute says. Major Barrett pointed out that this is yet another case where CAF is doing that, because quite plainly, quite clearly in 31 Bravo, there is no mention of counsel.
It is actually very black and white.
Yes. Both sort of literally and figuratively in that sense. So
you have a color copy of the MCM? Is that what you're talking about?
Even if I had a color copy, Major Squires, the text would still be black on white paper.
It is literally black and white, yes. I've never seen a color printed version of Article 31 Bravo. I don't know why you said that.
I don't know how we got here. On that note, that's all I've got for the fields. That's all I've got for United States versus Flanner. Major Squires, you want to take us out of here?
That's all for today. Thank you for listening. Looking forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.